that this is the 27th of April, 1996. And my name is Mike Grayson, and I'm sitting here with Dr. Rick Hoenig. And we're going to do a oral history about Rick's contributions to mass spectrometry. And traditionally, we start an interview of this type with a little digging into a little bit about the how you got involved in a technical or a scientific area at an early age, high school, your early education. Was there any particular point in time when you saw science, technical career as being interesting, challenging, rewarding?
Yes, the interest was greatly furthered when I was in the last 2 years of high school, of all places, in Istanbul, Turkey, at a German high school. And we had excellent teachers in math, chemistry, and physics.
Could we back up a minute and find out why you were in Istanbul, Turkey, in a German high school?
Certainly. I was born in Göttingen, Germany in 1917, at the worst possible time. We lived there until 1933, when my good father, who was professor of law at Göttingen University, was kicked out by the Nazis on the very first shift. He was not only anti-Nazi, well, very well known, he also had a bad heritage as far as the Nazis were concerned.
When you say the very first shift,
there was the very first shift of six professors on the 27th of April 1933 that were dismissed, and my father was one of them, along with Courant, later on Born. James Franck was one who retired on his own volition. So that was the beginning of the end for the scope and fame of Göttingen, Göttingen University. We went then in the fall of 1933, that is, my family and I, two younger brothers, parents, myself, to Istanbul, Turkey, where my father had been engaged to help in making education in Turkey changed into a European-style education, as opposed to the Islamic. That's why we were in Turkey. That's why I spent my last 2 years of high school in Turkey at the German university, German school. I then went to Istanbul, to Robert College, Istanbul, the American college, existing then, no longer exists as such.
Was this a small school, Robert College?
It was a smallish school. It was not by any means first rate. And I took, since physics was not available as such, I took the electrical engineering course and graduated after 3 years with a BS EE in 1938. Then I went, together with my father at that time, to the United States, and I enrolled at MIT for graduate work.
At MIT at that time, was it, I mean, it's always been a prestigious institution. Was it difficult for you to enroll because, as you indicated, your undergraduate training was perhaps not as good as it could have been?
It was not difficult because I happened to be pretty much at the top of our class at Robert College. But I found many, many open areas that needed to be patched over. So that's where I got interested in electronics, physical electronics, and a course in nuclear physics. And it was that course of nuclear physics then that got me very interested in such things as atoms, molecules, and particularly isotopes. And I learned whatever there was to be learned about mass spectrometry at the time.
The interest in mass spectrometry, was that because you had an analytical interest in?
That analytical interest was caused by, due to a part-time job that I had with what was known as the the origin of petroleum. And that origin of petroleum was based, that research project was based on the assumption that maybe lower, smaller molecules of carbon hydrogen combinations could be polymerized due to natural radioactivity. So we carried out some projects taking methane and subjecting it to deuteron radiation, subjecting it to alpha rays. And then I decided to try to see what came out of it. It seemed that mass spectrometry was the way to go.
Who was the sponsor of this activity?
It was sponsored jointly by the physics department and by people in I'm trying to think.
That's quite okay, no rush.
That's where my gaps come in. We had a Professor Whitehead in a different department who was a geologist, was really in the geology department. So at the time I was completely ignorant about how to build a mass spectrometer, and I had practically no guidance at all. In fact, we tried to approach Al Neer at the time, but Al Neer was not available because he was working on the ultra secret project, which of course we couldn't know.
So this would have been what year?
That was 1942.
42, okay. So let's see, you had graduated from Robert College in 38. And enrolled at MIT. Did you enroll like immediately the following fall?
Or? Right away.
Okay.
Right away.
So you had been doing graduate work for like 3 years or so by this time.
Well, actually there was a gap of 1 year when funds ran out for me, and I taught physics and mathematics at a very small college in Ohio, Bluffton, Ohio, Bluffton College.
So you actually departed from the Boston area?
Departed from the Boston area for 1 year, came back in, now that I was away 1940-41, and I came back in 41, I guess, that's correct. And in about 42, I was ready to do something about mass spectrometry.
And as you say, by then Neer was pretty much involved.
Was involved and not available for consultation at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I was completely on my own. There was nobody at MIT who knew anything about mass spectrometry. In fact, the professor who taught nuclear physics tried to dissuade me. He said there have been people in California who've been working for many, many years on this, and it's a very difficult area. So I proceeded to build a mass spectrometer, and let me say at the outset, in retrospect, I'm far from being proud about it, but it did work. It had the fabulous resolving power of 1 in 100.
Well, you know, that's better than many first attempts. Then did you work primarily from the literature?
I worked from the literature. I read all the literature. And eventually I had a chance to visit one or two laboratories, three laboratories, I guess. One was Hippel's laboratory in
was he at Westinghouse?
At Westinghouse. Another laboratory here in the neighborhood was a commercial laboratory that had bought a commercial spectrometer from what now is known as, or was known subsequently as a CEC. At that laboratory, I noticed how they were introducing gases, but they wouldn't tell me what the trick was. They were not allowed to. So I inspected the gas inlet system, then drew my own conclusions, and in fact wrote my first paper, which was a pretty good paper, on gas flow in the mass spectrometer. And I realized that the gas flow had to be a molecular flow in order to make, to give you true results. So eventually the mass spectrometer worked, and I was able to get some fairly preliminary results. And in 1943, I was able to base my thesis on this and get my PhD.
What was the design? Was it?
It was a near type 60-degree deflection. Well, 120-degree deflection, depending on how you measure 120 degrees, which was based on the fact that I wanted to get the biggest possible radius for the best possible resolving power. And everything that I had at that time, of course, was inherited or borrowed from what was available at the labs at MIT, because our funds were exceedingly limited, and during that wartime you couldn't get it anyhow.
Okay, so you were kind of in the opposite situation that Neer was in, where basically he had everything at his disposal in terms of equipment and the latest in tubes and electronic devices, whereas you were basically didn't have anything, the latest and greatest, and had to kind of patch it together.
It was, yes, a bootstrap operation, and to record the ions, I used the elephantine FP54 tube and an old-style galvanometer.
So was that one of these measurements that you had to, like, increase...
Point by point.
Point by point.
Point by point. I had to manually obtain a spectrum.
Were you varying the magnetic field or the...
I was varying at that time with that instrument the accelerating potential rather than the magnetic field.
What was the accelerating potential in the instrument? I mean, what was its highest capable?
Well, there, I can't give you a hard fact, but it probably was no more than 2,000 volts, down to maybe 400. So it had to be done in stages, and I had to vary the magnetic field. The magnet was actually fed by a system, a DC supply in the basement of MIT that had on it a huge switching arrangement with mercury contacts, mercury pools, very healthy.
Yes. And so this was like a house supply kind of
thing? A house supply, and it was clearly not feasible to change the magnetic field very readily, but I could change it.
And then this was used to look at organic materials?
This was used to look at the organic materials that were generated by taking methane, ethane, gases, and irradiating them in a cyclotron for deuteron radiation or to alpha rays from a radioactive source.
And what was the result of these experiments?
The result of these experiments was that, yes, these gases will polymerize into heavier hydrocarbons, but whether that really answered the question that was the original purpose isn't clear to me, because these hydrocarbons were very complex.
Mm-hmm.
They were not just far from being straightforward.
How did you deal with the issue of fragmentation in organic compounds? Did you use a low ionization potential for the ion source? Or?
That problem I tackled much later when I spent, not much later, while I was for 4 years working at what was known then as Zucconi Vacuum Laboratories in Paulsboro, New Jersey. Zucconi Vacuum, now Mobile. At the time, that laboratory was known in the neighborhood as, quote, the vacuum, unquote. And there I was from 1946 to 1950. And in between, I still stayed on for 2 years at MIT. I might also say that half of my time was spent on teaching. Of course, these were basic courses, first year and second year physics.
What was the class size that you had to deal with at that time?
The class size, I would say about 30 or so.
So before we move forward, I would like to maybe back up and was there a particular teacher back in your high school days, or you indicated it was in the latter 2 years of your high school education, I think, that you
yes,
started to get
interested.
Yes, there
were two teachers. One teacher's name was Grindel, G U umlaut N D E L, a very bright, very capable man who taught us physics and some math. The other teacher was equally capable and very nice, was a Dr. Julius Stern, or Stern, S-T-E-R-N. At that time he was the only leftover Jewish teacher at the German high school, and then had to leave. Those two teachers were able to further my interest in math. I might say that my education in Germany had been strictly a classical education that started with Latin, some rudimentary English, a lot of Greek. So for 7 years I learned more about classical languages and next to nothing about science.
What did Dr. Stern teach?
He's taught chemistry and some of our math courses. And in fact, I still, through a classmate of mine only about 2 years ago, had contact with this Dr. Stern before he died. He was still in Istanbul.
So, the move from Germany probably changed the whole direction of your life in many more ways than just physically relocation.
Yes, although I know, looking back, I realized that I began to be interested in mathematics, say, at age 13 or so. And there again, that school in Germany did not teach you much math, and less physics, and less chemistry at all.
So if you had stayed in Germany, your education would have been very classical, and you would have perhaps not even become involved in science.
Well, I think I would have, but it would have taken a little longer. Yes. Because I was not interested in following my father's career, who had taught law, as I mentioned earlier.
Okay, then to move forward now, you graduated from MIT in 1943, and you were able to find...
Excuse me, correction. It was 1944.
Okay.
It was 1944.
And you were able to find employment?
Then
readily.
I stayed at MIT for 2 years, from 1944 to 1946, continuing teaching, continuing on that project.
Who was your essentially thesis advisor?
A thesis advisor. His name was Goodman, G-O-O-D-M-A-N. But he was essentially more interested in geology and knew next to nothing about the specific physics, except he knew quite a bit about nuclear physics. But nobody at MIT at that time had been even remotely aware of mass spectrometry.
Do you have any idea what happened to the mass spectrometry After you left?
Yes, I do. I do. A successor to my job in that, on that project, was later on attempting to run the mass spectrometer, but unfortunately connected the magnetic field in such a way that he could only see negative ions. And I was called in 1946 on a consulting basis to find out what the trouble was, and with the help of a checking on the magnetic field, I straightened them out very quickly. So I won't tell you who it was, because he became quite well known in the field of making mass spectrometers later on.
Well, but it would be nice to know.
No. I better not.
But, well, this mistake is somewhat common. It's a simple mistake.
It's a simple mistake,
and
yes.
Easy to make.
But you see, the mass spectrometer was running when I left. And later on, for some reason or other, it had been disconnected and it had been reconnected, but unfortunately in the wrong way.
Well, he was just doing negative ion work ahead of his time.
So, then jumping forward from 46 to 50, being at Zirconi Vacuum, who had the idea of establishing a research laboratory after the war, and called in some very capable people. In fact, one of my colleagues was Gregory Vanier. I'll spell the Vanier. W-A-N-N-I-E-R, originally Swiss, a high-powered mathematician who, in fact, very kindly worked with me on one project, and the one paper that I am proud of that period was a way of measuring ionization potentials in hydrocarbon gases, which at that time, up to that point, had been pretty much hit or miss. But I found out very soon that that laboratory was not really going anywhere. And after 4 years, I decided it was high time to leave, which I did, and went to RCA Laboratories, where some of my former MIT colleagues were.
Before we start in the RCA experience, I was curious, why was vacuum part of the name of the Zirconi Vacuum Enterprise? What?
They made gasoline, and why they called it vacuum, I honestly don't know. And eventually, they apparently decided that there was a better way, and they called Mobile with the flying horse. That was after my time.
Yeah, but okay, so I don't know, maybe it was just something in the war that they had perhaps tried to disguise the operation, because I know that making of fuel and the technology of fuel was a very hot topic during the war.
Well, of course, but whether there was any vacuum involved, I seriously doubt it.
And also, I'd like to, without revealing the name of anyone, I was curious you know, we know that Professor Beeman has made quite a name for mass spectrometry at MIT in recent years. I was just wondering if there's any connection between the mass spectrometry that you left at MIT and Professor Beeman's...
Not to my knowledge. I think Klaus Beeman came to MIT much later. In fact, the first time I met him was at a mass spectrometry, international mass spectrometry meeting in Oxford. And it may have been in 1961, perhaps. I may be off a year. And that's where